The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. We thank you for listening to the show today. It's not all just politics as usual this fall on Capitol Hill. There's a rare show of bipartisanship in the Senate Judiciary Committee, where members there are drafting legislation to reform the federal criminal justice system. If those reforms pass, they could prompt changes at the state and local level, too. And this is a subject I dedicated some attention to last week on this show. And today, we begin right here in New York, where the Rikers Island Jail Complex, which has been owned by the city of New York since the 1880s, is home to more than 9,700 inmates and has earned itself the title of being one of the most notorious jails in the country. Back in June, the jail came under intense scrutiny after the death of 22-year-old Kalief Browder. Browder was accused of stealing a backpack and spent 3 years in Rikers before hanging himself after finally getting out. Maybe partially in response, New York City's council passed new legislation earlier this month to tighten oversight of the city's jails. The new rules require jail officials to create an inmate bill of rights and a code of conduct to be distributed to every inmate upon arrival. Those rules were just the latest in a series of reforms for the city's troubled correction system. In March, Mayor Bill de Blasio took special aim at the Rikers Island facility, announcing new measures to crack down on smuggling and violence.
Everything we're talking about today is about fundamental reform, is about launching a new era here on this island where violence will decrease steadily. It is about changing the culture of this place, and it's about addressing, bluntly, years of neglect.
Statewide here in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo's administration is also starting to put in place new systems to make it easier for former inmates to get jobs, to access health care, and to find housing after coming out of prison. Mary Buser spent a decade working on Rikers as a mental health professional. In a new book, Lockdown on Rikers, Shocking Stories of Abuse and Injustice at New York's Notorious Jail, she chronicles her experiences of that time. Mary Buser told me that above all, her time working with Rikers inmates led her to believe that solitary confinement is a form of torture.
It's wrong. This comes from my own personal experience standing at cell doors. Recently, the UN Rapporteur on Torture has said that anything over 15 days is torture, which I think is very telling. It drove people to all kinds of self-destructive behavior. There was arm cutting. There were makeshift nooses. There was just incoherent babbling. This is a very grueling psychological punishment. People become unglued. If they had no mental health issues before they entered solitary, then typically they will. Virtually everyone in there was on some kind of psychiatric medication to try and withstand it. This is legally sanctioned, carried out in jails and prisons across the country, and I ultimately came to the conclusion that legally sanctioned or not, it is wrong.
You told yourself, I think, when you first saw solitary that, hey, these are bad people who must have done something to deserve this kind of punishment.
Yes, I did. I did. Because that's the hype about solitary confinement, that it houses the worst of the worst, the baddest of the bad, the most incorrigible people in the world. What else could we do with them but put them in here? And when I started off working in what at Rikers is actually called the Bing, I had a hope that this was really true as a way to help me to rationalize the deterioration I was seeing in these human beings inside these cells. And ultimately, I came to realize that that is very, very exaggerated, that many of the punished inmates in solitary have something called impulse control disorders, not so much that they won't obey orders, but more that they can't. Nothing like at all the Hannibal Lecters we like to imagine are in there. Others are in there for very, very minor infractions, an outburst in the hallway. Solitary is the answer to everything. When I was on Rikers, there were no incentives for good behavior. Just stepping out of line and in the smallest way imaginable, you could wind up in solitary confinement. Additionally, which is very disturbing, while I was there, general population beds were scarce. The jails were packed, and firsthand, I was told by an officer, friendly officer, that there were under orders, the officers, to write people up for anything because every person you put into solitary, you opened up a GP bed. And that's just appalling, but true. So sometimes people are in there, hardly the baddest of the bad, worst of the worst. They're there as a function of just logistics.
Well, look, there are rules. There are laws that govern mental institutions on a thing called seclusion and restraint. Basically, if you put a mental patient, if I can use that term, into solitary confinement, or if you restrain them to a bed. And those rules say you can't do it for convenience and you can't do it for punishment. You can only do it if that person is a danger to themselves or a danger to the staff. Mm-hmm. Why don't those rules apply in prisons when often they're the same people?
Yes, they are. Because solitary is used as a deterrent to jailhouse misbehavior, which does raise an important issue. There needs to be a way to safeguard correctional staff, civilian staff, and other inmates. I don't think solitary confinement could be the answer as it exists now.
I mentioned mental institutions, mm-hmm. and I want to talk about them a little bit with you because there was a move in the 80s to deinstitutionalize mental hospitals. And even the Supreme Court had a ruling that said that mentally ill people had to be treated in the least restrictive way possible. We're no longer going to warehouse the mentally ill in mental hospitals. Now it seems like places like Rikers and hundreds of other places across the country have simply become the new warehouses.
Absolutely. Jails and prisons, especially in New York City, are the new caretakers of the mentally ill. And the tragedy of the shutdown of those hospitals, those big state hospitals, which had become snake pits in and of themselves, what was proposed at that time would be, in conjunction with the shutdown, would be the creation of community-based housing, where people who just can't cut it on their own, even on medication, could be cared for, overseen, have a warm bed, medicated, etc. That very critical piece never came to pass, and that is a tragedy that it did not. And what happened was you have people who just, as I said, can't cut it on their own, just in a free fall, can't make it, fall through the cracks, come into contact with the police, usually for petty sorts of things like loitering, trespassing. And the only answer is Rikers Island. I think it's really a disgrace in a civilized society that this is how we're caring for our mentally ill.
Now, violent crime, Mary Buser, is down across the country over the last 30 years, down sharply. Mm-hmm. But in many U.S. cities, including New York, there's been an increase over the last year. Some reporting out of New York, even in this last week, suggests that the spike in shootings and murders right here in New York are being perpetrated by young people who take up gang affiliations during their time in Rikers, that if they weren't in gangs going in, that by hanging out in Rikers sometimes for 18 months or 2 years, they develop those relationships in there, they come out, and they're even more violent than when they went in. I wonder if that surprises you at all based on what you experienced in your years there.
Certainly, jails, especially Rikers, have been characterized as breeding grounds for gangs, and I think that's very true. However, there's one big reason for that, and it's fear. Once you are in a gang, you have protection. And Rikers is a scary place, very scary. And it's understandable. I wonder if any of us in those circumstances wouldn't sign up for a gang. As far as what happens when they leave Rikers, it leaves an indelible mark, especially if you're there for, you know, a year and a half, 2 years. It's not surprising. It's a very hopeless place. It's futility. There's nothing positive going on. I think a person will be very transformed coming out of there, and not for the better.
Mary Buser, criminal justice reform is on the agenda in Washington and across the country. I've been covering it. We've been covering it on this show. Those reforms are expected to trickle down to states and cities and municipalities once the federal system is reformed. If they gave you the pen and told you to write in your favorite three provisions about what needs to change, what would you do?
What would I do? Well, I've thought about this a lot. Number one, I would get the what we called in mental health severe and persistent mental illness. I would get the mentally ill out of our jails and prisons. I would, if I had that magic wand, create that community housing. these poor people are suffering badly enough trying to get their brains to function, that would clear out a big number of the incarcerated. The next thing that I would do would be the felony. Felonies are handed out like candy. What happens is people will accept that felony, speaking about Rikers specifically, just to get the hell off Rikers Island. They will take a plea bargain offer instead of going to trial. They'll sign anything to get out of there. So now they have a felony. Once you have a felony, you are permanently barred from mainstream society. I think that felony, instead of it being handed out like candy, should be handed out only in cases where there's a serious or violent crime, not the way it's just given to everyone. And these people, they accept it without any understanding of what it really means. And what happens is when they cannot get jobs, they exist in a fringe-type way, getting what they can here and there. It's an unstabilizing existence, and in many cases, their lack of ability to get a job just leads right back to drugs. This barrier has to be very carefully examined because all it's doing is perpetuating this underclass and this chaotic and painful lifestyle.
A correction system that's not at all corrective but punitive, and a new warehousing system for the mentally ill. Mary Buser is author of Lockdown on Rikers, Shocking Stories of Abuse and Injustice at New York's Notorious Jail. Mary Buser, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
It's Todd Zwillick. Welcome back to The Takeaway. And let's go back to the UN now, because Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko addresses the United Nations General Assembly today. He's hoping to drum up support as Russia continues to threaten Ukraine's eastern border. And President Obama did touch on the subject during his UN remarks yesterday.
We cannot stand by when the sovereignty and territorial integrity of a nation is flagrantly violated. If that happens without consequence in Ukraine, it could happen to any nation gathered here today.
But here's the thing. The crisis in Ukraine appears to be falling off of the world's attention. There's Syria, there's a mounting refugee crisis, a war against the self-proclaimed Islamic State, and Poroshenko worries that his country is going to get short shrift at the UN this week. It's been more than a year since Russia annexed Crimea, and Vladimir Putin continues to support rebels in eastern Ukraine. And while Putin and Poroshenko agreed to a ceasefire last February, there are still lots of details to work out before its implementation deadline at the end of the year. Joining us is Miroslava Gongadze. She's TV anchor and chief of Voice of America's Ukrainian service. Miroslava, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, as I mentioned, there is a ceasefire in Ukraine, but it's tenuous. What's the situation now, and what is Poroshenko's message to the UN?
The peace is very fragile right now, and everybody kind of hold on and wait for some new development on the east. Poroshenko came to UN to actually to bring attention to Ukrainian issue, and as well as talking about the needs of reforming UN. Ukraine is participating in UN peacekeeping mission. 34,000 Ukrainian soldiers were part of the peacekeeping mission, and Ukraine wants to have a bigger stake at UN. So one message of President Poroshenko is to needs to reform UN, and second message is to help Ukraine to deal with Russia.
At the same time, it seems that at least the tacit message that Poroshenko is bringing here is that this ceasefire is indeed fragile, and he may be facing an aggressive Vladimir Putin once everybody at the UN goes home.
Unfortunately, right now, Russia is not stepping away from the east. Russia is building a big military base on the eastern border of Ukraine. They are keeping supplying weapons to the fighters on the east. They are sending their troops. Actually, OSCE just released a new report and showed the evidence of Russian military participation in the east. They send the newest weaponry to the east, so they're not planning to go away. Minsk agreement requires all the weaponry, heavy weaponry, to move out of Ukrainian east and actually securing the border of Ukraine. It's not happening. So we have only 3 months left for Russia to actually fulfill the Minsk agreement. It doesn't look it will happen. Actually, quite opposite. Ukrainian experts are seeing a build-up of military, and a lot of people are expecting new offensive operation from Russia. The only time out is when Putin is in UN, and it's very hard to actually read his next step and what he would be doing next. He's very humiliated in the international arena. I mean, he did it for himself, but he came to UN, he sent his weaponry to Syria just to get new attention for Russia and get a seat at the table with President Obama. And he got what he wanted. Obama met him, and they talked about Ukraine, they talked about Syria, they shaked hands, and basically it looks like the Western community are ready to deal with Putin again, even when he actually breaking the international rules, when he's breaking the world order, when he's doing whatever he thinks he can do, and he will go as far as the West will let him. And he's not fighting Ukrainians in Ukraine, he's fighting United States in Ukraine. We should have heard him talking yesterday at UN. He said that all Ukrainian revolution was created on the West, and that in Syria he's fighting US as well. He wants to build a new Russia. He wants to show that Russia is the biggest and most powerful country in the world, and it's very, very dangerous move. The West taking Putin as bad-behaved boy. He's not bad-behaved boy. He's a criminal, and we are just closing our eyes on all his crimes, first around Russian border in former Soviet Union countries, and now he's moving to the Middle East.
But then part of the question is what new argument Poroshenko can bring to President Obama. Look, everyone in Washington, in Congress and outside of Congress, wants to send U.S. weapons to the government in Ukraine. President Obama has made clear he's not interested in that, not interested in arming Ukraine against these factions in the East or against the Russians. Can Poroshenko make a new argument to make that so?
I hope he would. The issue is that a lot of experts are saying that United States in particularly don't really understand what's going on in the East. Ukraine is only democratic country with legitimate government. If United States and NATO could help them to contain Russia in their border, it would be a success story for the West. Tension of the West is spread so thin everywhere, specifically in the Middle East, but we have something that we can actually win. Supporting Ukraine, we are supporting, first of all, the peace in that part of the world that can be done and can be done easily, sending weapons, sending supporting Ukraine financially and politically. And then in parallel, we can deal with Middle East. But Ukraine is one country that actually can be a success story for Obama. Unfortunately, it doesn't look he understands that, and he doesn't believe in the weaponry, but we would not be able to contain Russia if we would not support Ukraine. And Ukraine is fighting not only their own war against Russia, Ukraine is fighting for the peace in Europe. And I hope international community would understand and European community would understand that, and finally maybe Obama would understand that.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko is in front of the United Nations General Assembly today, essentially trying to remind the world that his eastern border is still threatened and trying to rally American support against Russian influence in his country. Miroslava Gongadze, TV anchor and chief of VOA's Ukrainian service, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
We go now to Alaska, where the surprise of Royal Dutch Shell's decision to pull its 9-year effort to explore for oil in the Alaskan Arctic is now sinking in. Local Alaskans and members of the oil and gas industry are left wondering how the state will move forward without Shell's multi-billion dollar venture in the Chukchi Sea. Joining me now is the governor of Alaska, Bill Walker. Governor, welcome.
Thank you very much, Don.
A big shock, I imagine. Down here in the lower 48, it was a big shock. In Alaska, it must have been huge.
It was a huge shock. We were prepared for something very different than the announcement we received Sunday night.
So how are the local communities and the local economies reacting in your state? So many people have been on our show, have been on the air, have been in the papers saying that this huge investment from Shell was going to mean a lot to their jobs, to their communities, to their businesses.
Well, it is a big shock. They have hundreds of employees in Alaska and lots of contractors. So we were prepared for a different result, and recognizing that the oil from we anticipated they were going to find in the Chukchi Sea, actually the way the revenue sharing works, with the state of Alaska would not receive any revenue, but plenty of jobs and opportunities for employment up here.
Give people a sense of the importance of drilling to Alaska. Everybody's heard Drill Baby Drill. Everybody remembers Governor Palin and what a big deal it is to Alaskans. But people may not be aware that residents of your state get direct subsidies. They get checks because of the concessions and the contracts for drilling. It's very important to people's livelihoods.
Well, it does. We wouldn't necessarily from the offshore, because the offshore, again, the revenues are not shared with the state of Alaska, unlike some of the other states. I think Florida receives revenue sharing from offshore drilling, but Alaska does not. So it's a different type. We've discovered over the years, not every barrel of oil is equal up here as far as the revenue standpoint, but from the jobs point of standpoint, it absolutely is.
Governor Bill Walker of Alaska, you said on Twitter yesterday that you've called into the White House to ask for a meeting on the way forward. Have you gotten one? Where does that stand?
You know, I have not heard back from my scheduler about that. I traveled with the president when he came to Alaska on Air Force One. I met with him at Andrews Air Force Base and flew up with him. So I had a chance to talk to him about resource development in our great state. So I expect I will have a meeting. I did speak with the Secretary Jewell yesterday, and I'll meet with her probably next week in D.C.
So oil prices are low. We had an analyst on yesterday, Governor, who said, look, they still think that there's an ocean of oil under the offshore shelf in Alaska. It's just that oil prices are low. The break-even price on a barrel is so high now that it's not worth it. But it still seems, if you're for drilling in Alaska, that the future at least is bright, just maybe not right this minute.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. I met with Shell yesterday, and they sort of laid out their drilling plan, and they're very optimistic. There's plenty of oil up there. They didn't hit it where they drilled, and that's unfortunate. But it's shallow water, unlike the deep water in the Gulf, and so it's a very different profile up here. So they think there's plenty of oil up there. They just didn't hit it on this particular venture.
And your response to the environmental groups who are viewing this as a huge victory, they were, I dare say, crowing a bit yesterday that Shell pulled out. They didn't want this drilling in the first place.
Well, I certainly understand that. I'm glad I live in a country that people can express their different views on things. And I think in Alaska, we're all very concerned about the environment. We live here. We're born here. This is our home, our front yard, and our backyard. So we're all concerned about that. I spent time on the Shell drill rig in Seattle when it was having some work done. Mm-hmm. I was very impressed with the number of backup features on that drill rig, the kind of protection that was available. So I was very comfortable with their drilling in our offshore waters.
Governor Bill Walker of Alaska, Shell Oil has pulled out of its effort to drill in the Chukchi Sea. Governor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Before dawn on Monday, the Taliban took control of the Afghan city of Kunduz. It's a strategically important city that serves as a transport hub for the north of the country. Afghanistan said it's deployed hundreds of troops to the north to help retake that city. It's the first provincial capital to be retaken by the Taliban since losing power in the 2001 U.S.-led invasion when the Taliban surrendered Kunduz. But the Taliban's reclaiming of the town is being considered their most significant victory in 14 years. With more is Carlotta Gall, senior correspondent for The New York Times, who reported for a decade from Afghanistan. She's the author of The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014. Carlotta Gall, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What's the latest? What are you hearing from your contacts in Afghanistan about Kunduz?
So the government is announcing that they're making operations to retake the city, and there's fighting on the edge of the city. The government forces retreated to the airport, which is outside the town. And now we've heard that American forces are assisting them and have actually been doing some air support, which means bombing Taliban positions, but outside the town, from what I understand. So I think what's happening is that the government's trying to make inroads into the city, but they're fighting on the edge. So it's going to be quite a struggle to actually retake the whole of Kunduz.
And militarily, I had read that this was not the case of an overwhelming Taliban force. It was a relatively small band of fighters, but Afghan security forces that were very, very numerous, poorly commanded.
That makes it sound easy, but I think probably what happened was that the Taliban did attack from three sides, and they're very skilled at pinpointing the positions of the government troops and overrunning them. And then you get a sort of fallback and perhaps a collapse of morale on the government side. So you don't always need a much bigger force to overrun government positions around a town. What is amazing is that the government then abandoned the police station and the intelligence headquarters and the governor's place. Those are big central positions you would have thought they would fight for. So that, I think, shows a collapse of morale or lack of local leadership.
And it also seems troubling in a period where the U.S. is endeavoring to train and fund Afghan security forces that they performed so poorly in this last episode, doesn't it?
Well, I think we've seen this for several years, that the Americans have struggled to stand up the Afghan army and police forces. And then they've tried to also recruit local militias to try and bring up the strength. They have struggled. In some places, the Afghan army has been very efficient. But here, I think Kunduz has been under siege for some time. The Taliban have really been rallying in the districts for over a year, targeting the place and undermining the districts and the morale. So I think it's been, you know, long in coming, perhaps, this, but it does show how difficult it is for the Afghan army to hold on. And this is the first provincial capital to fall. But of course, now everyone's wondering how many others will come under attack.
Yes. And then the question is, how big of a prize is it for the Taliban? What does it show for them in terms of capability or propaganda within the country and in front of the world that they were able to take a medium-sized city like this?
Right. Huge propaganda value. What is questionable is, will they try and hold it now? Because to hold it, I think they'll probably try and make a show of force. They'll try and, you know, maul the government troops that try and take it back. But can the Taliban hold a city? I don't think they're ready for that yet. And I think they might just skip out after some time, whether it's hours or days or. But the propaganda value, to show that they're a force to be reckoned with, that they're not just hit and run guerrillas in the hills, this is an enormous morale booster for them and a fantastic blow to the government, which is divided and struggling to stand up on its own with the removal of the NATO and American troops.
Ashraf Ghani has been president for almost exactly a year, right at the time where NATO has pulled out, the United States is diminishing its role. And you said this is a major blow, but inside the country, in terms of perceptions of his ability to govern, this has to be a huge setback.
Huge setback. I mean, I've talked to Afghans since yesterday, and they're very, very disappointed. They're feeling that this government isn't capable of defending them. They think this is just a harbinger of something more to come. So very disappointed. And of course, the Afghan government is divided. Ashraf Ghani, you know, is the president, and he's supposed to be working in a unity government with chief executive Abdullah, but actually they're very divided. They both feel they won the election. They don't agree with how to tackle the Taliban. Ashraf Ghani wants to do peace talks. Abdullah is very against that. So there's going to be a lot of hand-wringing and, I think, discussions in the days to come of how the country can pull together to fight off the Taliban.
And Carlotta Gall, the United States has some decisions to make here. Is there a chance that the president decides to ramp up an American military role to beat the Taliban back? Or is that just not in the cards?
Well, we've all seen, I think, that President Obama has been always against that. He's tried to wind down the war in Afghanistan. He's tried to pull out the troops. But I think this is certainly going to be a shocking reminder that if there's too hasty a withdrawal or a complete withdrawal, this is what we will see more of. The Taliban will just push more and hit the government where they can. So I think it shows more than ever how much trainers and enablers, and here we see airstrikes, are actually still needed from the Americans. So I think it's going to be a very sharp reminder that to pull out more or to leave the Afghans coping on their own is not going to work.
Reassessments in Washington and the White House and the Pentagon, surely. Hand-wringing in Kabul in the one-year-old government there. Carlotta Gall, senior correspondent for The New York Times. She's the author of Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001 to 2014. Again, the Taliban has retaken the northern city of Kunduz. Carlotta Gall, thank you for your help.
Thank you.
Coming up next, lies. Now, we've gotten lots of responses from you about how lying is worth it, but not all of you. Some of you stick to the notion that lying is wrong.
This is Michelle from Honolulu calling. This is your question about lying. Well, it's never worked for me. In fact, years ago, I had a situation at work where telling the truth made me look pretty bad. I told the truth anyway. The manager involved with that conversation thanked me for my honesty and also said he would have fired me then and there if I had lied to him.
And this comes to us from Austin, Texas. Even though I have gotten away with telling a lie to my husband in the past, I couldn't do it again. I can't risk that relationship. You can tweet us anything, including your lies. That's fine. We're at The Takeaway. You can also follow me at Todd Zwillick.
I've lied on pretty much every job interview ever, and I've gotten the job, so I'll probably continue to do that. However, I think it's a little bit weird saying that the system is set up on lying. The employee doesn't necessarily want my authentic self.
Robbie from Salt Lake City, you're onto something here, because especially in the workplace, bosses, leaders, they're told all the time leadership means being open and honest, being as transparent and accessible as possible. Always shoot straight. That's what a lot of the champion executive books and almost the entire leadership training industry says. Except it's BS. Really, according to the book Leadership BS, Fixing Workplaces and Careers One Truth at a Time, author Jeffrey Pfeffer says the truth about good leaders is that they're often really, really good liars.
What makes individuals successful is oftentimes the opposite of what people have been told to do. So while we're told to be modest and honest and take care of others and not self-promote, when you look at actually what produces leadership success, at least the success is defined by career advancement and achieving a high salary, it's pretty much the opposite of that.
So self-promotion, I understand. You've got to be able to sell yourself. You've got to be probably political. You've got to be willing to put yourself in front of others. But you said honest, that leaders shouldn't necessarily be honest.
Some of the greatest and most successful leaders in the history of business, and for that matter, politics, have not always told the truth. Abraham Lincoln, in order to settle the Civil War, was not completely honest about where the Southern delegation was. James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, when asked about whether or not national intelligence agencies were intercepting communications from the part of American citizens, didn't tell the truth, as we learned from Edward Snowden. And by the way, Mr. Clapper still has his job. Certainly Steve Jobs, with the idea of the reality distortion field. And in the software business generally, we have the idea of vaporware, which is this concept that when you ask a software producer about the product availability and its features, you may not get 100% an accurate or truthful response.
All right. Well, I've got a couple of examples for you, Jeffrey Pfeffer. If you're game, why don't you field a couple of powerful lies here and let's deconstruct them. How about it?
That sounds great.
All right. Listen to this one.
Under our proposal, if you like your doctor, you keep your doctor. If you like your current insurance, you keep that insurance. Period. End of story.
And that's President Obama selling the Affordable Care Act back in 2009. Jeffrey Pfeffer, we all know that that has now been recorded by history as a pretty famous political lie.
Well, I think that's an example that's actually not dissimilar to the Lincoln example I mentioned earlier, that sometimes in order to get a proposal accepted, you can't necessarily tell everything quite accurately about that proposal. So when Lincoln wanted to settle the Civil War, he had to make some lies about the Southern delegation and what the Southerners were willing to accept. When Obama wants to sell health care for everyone, he has to probably distort a little bit about some of the specifics of that health care plan.
Is that to imply that, you know, insurance for 25 or 30 million people is worth a presidential lie?
Absolutely, in my opinion.
All right, let's try another one.
Year after year, Saddam Hussein has gone to elaborate lengths, spent enormous sums, taken great risks to build and keep weapons of mass destruction.
No doubt about it, 2003, President George W. Bush at the State of the Union address, also another famous recorded lie of history. Probably President Bush felt like it was necessary.
That may be, but in both that case and the Obama case, one of the questions is not does a statement after the fact turn out to be inaccurate, but whether or not someone knows the statement is incorrect at the moment they're making it. And there are some people who believe that George Bush actually believed at the moment he was making that statement that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and that it was only in hindsight that they learned that they didn't. So a lie is telling something that you know not to be true at the moment you say it. And by the way, there's still plenty of examples of that as well, such as the tobacco industry executives testifying that they did not know about their own studies that smoking caused cancer when it turns out in hindsight that they did, or many of the financial industry executives at the time of the financial crisis saying that their balance sheets were in great shape and that and some of the banks saying that they would not have to raise extra capital, even though they knew that that was not the case.
So let's take a corporate lie ripped right out of the headline. Jeffrey Pfeffer, Volkswagen, which for many, many years perpetrated a lie by installing their malicious software into their cars that lied about the emissions of their diesel cars. We've all heard about that. That's a long-term lie. The cars are sort of lying on behalf of the people who made the decision. And then once they were caught, VW kind of laid everything out, said, yep, we lied. They came clean right away. There's a lot to unpack there in the annals of corporate mendacity.
There is a lot to unpack in the annals of corporate mendacity. Volkswagen is only one of many, including Volkswagen itself in an earlier version, who have tried to get around regulations on emissions and mileage by not always doing things on the up and up. But that's really kind of a, if you will, a technical lie, not a lie in a technical sense, but a lie in the sense that they have reprogrammed equipment to work not as quite as it was supposed to.
Right, but that sounds euphemistic. They've reprogrammed equipment to work not the way it was supposed to, but all of the advertisements, the sales job, everybody who drives that car during the terms of their ownership thinks that they're driving something different than what they're driving. It's much more than just a couple of lines of code.
That is correct. If you compare that, again, it's hard to know exactly who in Volkswagen did this or authorized it. But to go back to Ralph Nader, unsafe at any speed, uncovering the safety defects and an excess number of deaths from driving the Corvair, and General Motors denied those safety numbers. So lying in the auto industry has, again, a long and glorious or inglorious, depending upon your perspective, history and tradition. And one of the interesting questions you ought to ask then is why does that go on and why has this persisted over now 40 or 50 years? And let me suggest that one of the answers is because we do not criminalize that behavior in the sense that, yes, VW is going to pay, I don't know how many multiple billions of dollars, way more than the $7 billion that they have set aside. But I will guarantee you, with almost no fear of contradiction, no executive is going to go to jail.
And you've made the point pretty clearly in this book that there really isn't a lot of downside to lying at this level, even though we wish there were. And I kind of had to look at myself, Jeffrey Pfeffer. You know, a lot of what you're writing about rubs me the wrong way. As a journalist, I'm not naive. I know that politicians, the people I cover, I know that they lie. But the entire point of my career, the entire point of this show is truth telling. I can't have you on this radio show to say there's no downside. Get over it. Everybody does it. It's the way the world works. Goodbye. You know?
Well, if you want to change the world, you first have to understand how it is. And lying is common. Surveys show that the average person lies twice a day. Lying is often done to smooth over social relationships. If your partner says, does this outfit make me look fat? The correct answer is no. Do you love me as much as the day we first met 20 or 30 years ago? The correct answer is yes. So it doesn't do very much good to say thou shalt not lie. That's an interesting admonition, and it's probably a good one. But if we're going to create a world in which there's less lying, we need to understand why it occurs and what the sanctions are or not for engaging in it.
Jeffrey Pfeffer is professor of organizational behavior at Stanford, and he's author of Leadership BS, Fixing Workplaces and Careers One Truth at a Time. Jeffrey Pfeffer, thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Well, now that you've heard all about why leaders lie in the workplace, it's a good time to think about why you fudge the truth. Here are your closing thoughts on lying and whether it's always worth it.
This is Mary in New Jersey. So in 2008, in the midst of the recession, I got pulled over for talking on my phone while driving. Being pulled over terrifies me to the point of tears all on its own. So I rode that wave, telling the officer a lie that my husband had just called to tell me he was laid off, that we'd been waiting all day to hear his fate. And so when the phone rang, I just reflexively picked up the call without thinking about it. I nailed the performance. But I did worry afterwards about being kind of a psychopath.
So, lying with a conscience, you're not a psychopath, Mary. No way. You can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can tell the truth. You can tell lies. We'll sort them out. You can tweet us at The Takeaway as well. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry, hopefully with the truth all the time, or at least 95% of it. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA Cref, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. By Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.